This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, you're listening to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Darshan Johan, and today we're going to be talking about the 2020 Sabah elections. No, this is not an old episode, neither am I, you know, incredibly late to the party, I don't think. But the reason why we're revisiting the Sabah elections is because my guests on today's show, Bridget Welch, Vilashini Somaya and Benjamin Low, have recently published a book on the Sabah election. So it's called Sabah from the Ground, the 2020 Elections and the Politics of Survival. Welcome to the first episode of this new show, guys. How are y'all doing?
Great.
We're doing great. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
No, the pleasure is mine. So, Villa, it's been a few months now since the 2020 Sabah elections, right? Would deny that it was an exciting, heartbreaking and thrilling affair. Now, the whole country was paying attention. But yeah. I think for a lot of us here in Peninsula, we tend to see things through our lens, the lens of national politics, right? Or what does it mean for PH? What does it mean for BN and all these things? But what was the Sabah elections about to Sabahans themselves?
I think that's a great question. You framed it quite right. I think non-Sabahans, I would say, were watching an election unfold in which we were trying to understand the ways in which Sabah is going to fall into whose hands. So, you know, would it return to Warisan and, you know, a party that's obviously, you know, fighting for quote-unquote state autonomy, or was it going to go to, you know, the new government of Perikatan Nasional? And, you know, those things sort of read differently depending on where you were outside of Sabah. But the book that the three of us co-edited really points to this whole notion of surviving and survival, in the sense that there were many different narratives being played on the ground, and really which community you came from and the different kinds of groups that you sort of saw yourself represented would mean very different things. So you know, this would obviously read very differently depending on the ethnic community that you came from, right? Whether you were on a different side of Sabah, whether it was on the East Coast or West Coast, there were gender influences, obviously, there were class influences, and all these narratives were, you know, in very different and fascinating ways, complementary or in certain occasions, you know, conflicting. So this tells us that, you know, there's a really very interesting dynamics that's actually happening in Sabah. I'm Sabahan myself. So the way in which I understand voting and the patterns that goes along to voting, I vote in a place called Kepayat in Kota Kinabalu. But somebody who's voting, say, in Lahad Datu or in a place like Sugut or in Tawau would look at things completely differently. And of course, there are some notions of loyalties when they choose to vote for a particular candidate.
Right.
But there are many other things that are happening as well, right? And the way in which you understand voting for the greater good of your community or maybe even the greater good of your pocket, right? So I think generally this is the large idea that we want to share with our readers about the book and the way in which we see the book. You know, the writers also are able to sort of capture this in their various articles.
Now, Bridget, Villa brought up ethnic politics, right? How important is ethnic politics in Sabah, especially when compared to West Malaysia? Or are there other more important factors? Because when we think of Sabah and Sarawak even, it's more common for people to focus on individuals when compared to, you know, West Malaysia, where it's all about parties.
I think you're correct that the story and narrative often in Sabah is about personalities and persons. But I think it's important to understand why they're there, because they provide a kind of a network of support for people from the ground. But I think also the nature of ethnic politics in Sabah is very different. There are different communities to start with, and so that we have the Karazandu Sumurut, the KDM communities, the Chinese, the Muslim Bumiputra, the main communities people look at. But in fact, when you go dig deeper, right, there are actually, you know, a lot more smaller groups, and those smaller groups and communities and minorities also kind of factor in and very much at the local level. So So while issues of race and religion are on the issues that have been affecting Sabah politics, and many of those are coming from the peninsula, but also, in a sense, also becoming more important because this Sabah is one of the most largest Christian states. So these issues matter considerably. But there are also very different issues on the ground that mobilize around ethnic issues, such as the issues of migration and also, you know, how livelihoods and the well-being of different communities. And so we see a kind of different dynamic that is not the same as it is in Peninsula Malaysia.
Right.
And at the same time, there are other cleavages that matter just as important as ethnicity. And these have to do with issues of class, because you have a very high level number of poverty in Sabah, and people, you know, are trying to find a way to survive in this process. We see Sabah is still a majority rural. There's a lot of remote areas. We see gender and generational differences that, of course, are manifested in Peninsula Malaysia as well. But I think that, you know, when we think about ethnic politics, we have to recognize that there's more greater complexity and big differences, and to not to impose the model of what is happening in Peninsula Malaysia on a place like Sabah.
Villa, I want to ask you, you know, to explore with me the aspect of the book that I found very important, which is the KDM community. So for those who don't know, KDM is the Kadazan, Dusun and Murut community. Now, tell me about the KDM community, their political leanings, and why Shafi Abdal and Warisan failed to garner support in this community. Ultimately, that was one of the reasons for their defeat, right, at the state elections?
Right. You know, the KDM community is a really fascinating one. I guess people new to Sabah politics view KDM as a single ethnic group, right? The Kadazan, Dusun, Murut. But in fact, they are three very different ethnic groups with very different demands. One of the chapters in our books, written by Tony Bagang and Arno Puyok, really investigates this very beautifully, of course. And really, the larger issue that they're talking about is we cannot continue to see KDM politics as, you know, as two-dimensionally identical throughout. Is in the sense that what happens and what is demanded by the Kadazan community is different from what is demanded by the Dusun community and the Murut community. And I think this is an important point for us to make, right? Mm-hmm. You cannot just say the word KDM and assume that everything that they like and they think about is identical. And so really what the chapter looks at is this whole idea around personality politics, patronage, ethno-nationalism, and that, you know, there are these personalities within local politics that really fuels the way in which the KDM people essentially go out to vote, right? A very big personality in the KDM community is Jeffrey Kittingan, and this idea around the Huguan Siao. And, you know, these sort of things essentially helps, I think, the KDM community inform themselves about where they position themselves, because there's this huge idea of threats, right? Threats of the outsider. This is an ongoing political narrative that also exists in Sabah politics. And so I think for decades, KDM politics has been really informed by this idea of lessening rights and, you know, losing their position in the greater representation of Sabah politics.
Ben, I think sometimes when observing politics, right, we tend to fall in these pitfalls where we tend to label the politicians and their parties as, you know, good guys and bad guys, you know. So most Peninsula PH supporters, for example, were probably rooting for Warisan Plus to win the Sabah state elections, which Warisan Plus did not win. But outside of the drama and the catchy slogans lies a more nuanced world of politics, right? And one of the chapters in the book talks about Shafi Abdal's and Warisan's failings in terms of development and job creations while they were in power. And this was one of the reasons that they are lost, right? That they lost the state elections when they ran for it again. Now, tell me about Warisan's failings in these areas.
I think you're referring to essentially James and Marcella's chapter. And I think that's a very, very telling chapter that sort of highlighted how Warisan Plus essentially, or Warisan at the time, essentially took sort of like failed to take advantage or did not really see through a lot of the plans that they did with regards to trying to overcome the issue of unemployment, which was a very, very big issue going into this election. You know, combined with, and while people can be quick to discount that, the country was going through a COVID-19 pandemic, we locked down and whatnot, and that should naturally contribute to an increase in unemployment. But as his research shows, that the unemployment rates were already quite low, and a lot of the actions that Warisan had undertaken, while it may not have sort of like necessarily affected it much, some of these things were done, that including, you know, renegotiation of government contracts. They did contribute to it in a very, very drastic way as well. And so that was essentially the main problem that Warisan was doing. There was a lack of planning in sort of like undertaking many of these bigger picture based issues as well. And I think, as you can see from my own chapter, which is looking at the social media space, mm-hmm. you can sort of see the sort of like the interactions between how people from Warisan supporters were generally, instead of focusing on the unemployment issues, were generally focusing on these are the developments of infrastructure that were made, whereas the GRS supporter sides were really focusing much on the economic downturn that took place. Well, there is, of course, this argument about how Warisan was only in power for such a short amount of time. There was only so much they could do. But as James and Marcella highlighted, that, you know, there was actually, it could have been done a little bit more systematically. And they felt that they really dropped the ball on that particular issue.
Yeah, in fact, the chapter actually shows that Warisan should have, you know, fulfilled at least a portion of what they promised, but they didn't. Do you think if they did fulfill it, they would have performed better at the Sabah state elections?
Well, as we were looking through the campaign as well, we found that, you know, this was explained quite nicely in Bridget's chapter, sort of examining campaign. You can see that there was a lot of different approaches to how the campaigns were run. And I think this was most evident when we looked at how the presentation of the chief minister candidate during the course of election was presented. Warisan leaned very heavily onto Shafi Abdal. And as was pointed out in Philip Golingai's chapter, that some MPs, some of the representatives, political representatives that he sort of interviewed, actually highlighted that this was probably a mistake, in the sense that Shafi Abdal, charismatic he may be, is still a single person. And Sabah, which is not a small state, it may be a state in Malaysia, but it is, as a state alone, it is almost half the size of all of Peninsula Malaysia.
That's
and
right.
To have to rely on a single person to just sort of campaign throughout the entire 2 weeks of the election period was sorely not going to be enough. And this was contrasted with how GRS, rather than even present a chief minister candidate, just relied on using Perikatan Nasional image, symbolism and imagery, and also on the prime minister's image just for their campaign. And that sort of just shows the way the different approaches that they were going for, whereby Warisan was talking about how, you know, we need to be self-sufficient, we need to be united together as a state, whereas for GRS, in sort of like focusing more on the Perikatan Nasional focus, is saying that, oh, in order for Sabah to progress, we have to really be linked very, very closely with the federal government in that sense. So it's, there was sort of like a difference in approach, and I suppose the results do sort of reflect what different groups of people on the ground sort of reflect. And I think that's not really a fair way of trying to sort of sum up the entire election, because as you can see, we have multiple chapters examining different mm-hmm. ethnic groups and how different communities engage very, very differently with the election. You know, we have a chapter on the KDMs, you have the chapter on, you know, looking at the Chinese Sabahans, which had a very, very different approach to looking at the elections. And we also had the historical and the rather underrated presence of Islam in Sabah itself. So all of these things all combined together, and it's very difficult to sort of summarize it all together because it's a very, very complex election that took place.
And indeed, that's what we are doing, right? We're just summarizing the whole thing, because you're right. The book really dives deep. And in fact, if you really want, we can do a podcast on every single chapter and, you know, break down everything. So I think it's, you know, although we're talking about it right now, it's really worth checking out the book. But on that note, we do need to go for a very quick break. After the break, we'll be talking about Peninsula's influence in Sabah's politics. You're listening to Beyond the Ballot Box on BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Dashran Johan, and on the show with me today is Vilashini Somaiah, Benjamin Low, and a voice you hear very frequently on BFM, Bridget Welsh. So the three of them, together with a host of other contributors, have recently published a book called Sabah from the Ground, the 2020 Elections and the Politics of Survival. And that's what we are talking about today. Ben, tell me about Peninsula's influence in Sabah politics. I was particularly intrigued by the part where you talked about how over the years, politicians from the peninsula have attempted to force Sabah to conform to federal ideals. What do y'all mean when y'all wrote this part?
Well, the idea here is that, like the rest of peninsula, Sabah and also Sarawak by extension is seen as sort of like a vassal state. That's essentially one of the crux of the idea behind this whole push to sort of like return to the original wording and intention of the Malaysian Agreement 1963. And that was one of the chapters that we sort of highlight in the book, this desire to return to provide more autonomy towards Sabah in that sense. And at the same time, the federal government is, of course, very reliant on Sabah for its natural resources and is a major contributor to the country's GDP. And so we sort of like examine as to how, and I think this was sort of reflected again in the campaign, as I mentioned just now, that, there's this idea that in order to get any sort of like noticeable or considerable amount of development, it doesn't matter how strong the state government is, because you are desperately in need of having very, very strong links or at least very strong relationships with the federal government in order to get any sort of like considerable or sort of like noticeable progress. And I think that was a campaign that seemed to resonate with certain groups of people on the ground at the very least.
Bridget, I want to get your thoughts on this as well, because the book also talks about this idea of how for many years, peninsula politicians have tried to force Sabah, which is a uniquely diverse state, right? The entire Borneo is like that. They try to force Sabah to also buy into this idea of Ketuanan Melayu and Ketuanan Islam. What is your take on that?
It's clear that those issues are very important, and they feed into the ethnic politics that we've noticed before. And there is a lot of resentment that to sort of say, hey, these are the dynamics and narratives in Peninsula Malaysia, you should follow those narratives. In simple things, right? So the ethnic data in Sabah is categorized as non-Muslim Bumiputra and Muslim Bumiputra.
That's right.
But in fact, Muslim Bumiputra is so many different sets of groups. Mm. And non-Muslim Bumiputra are also that sets of groups, right? So why use this kind of paradigm and impose a paradigm on a communities that are much more diverse and complex? And this is one example of what of the feelings, that their sense of the politics of religion, the politics of race that are being exported on these sense of communities. And it signals a lack of respect or appreciation of the diversity. And I think that, it is very much evident when you talk to people on the ground that there is this growing sense of state nationalism, both in Sabah and Sarawak. Mm. And the federal government is blamed for a lack of respect and appreciation. And for the MA63 debate, while most of that we found is very much understood as and debated by elites, it's not something that the agreement doesn't resonate. But the sentiments, the sense of being of neglected or not having the same amount of services, which are really, very serious. And it's not just about internet. We're talking about health, access to education, access to water, access to electricity. The conditions on the ground are not where Sabahans deserve, and they're not nowhere near the standard that we find in other parts of Malaysia. And this is wrong. This unfairness, this inequality is wrong, and they are cognizant of that. And so while MA63, is the focal point of elites, the sentiments of state nationalism on the ground are real. And I think that this neglect and trying to sort of say you are the same as us is really is signaling a lack of appreciation and understanding of these communities that I think are very different.
Vila, I want to read to you a quote that stood out to me in the book. And it says, what is striking about our understanding of Sabah politics is how much is left out. Sabahans are given little agency. Sabah is acknowledged to be unique, but Sabah politics has been seen narrowly. Talk to me about this.
I think this particular quote really captures the way in which a lot of Sabahans feel, I think generally, is that on a personal level, I think when I was trying to find my voice as a really young junior academic, is that I was sort of battling with this idea of this exoticization of being Bornean and of course, of being Sabahan. This idea, it's a paradise, it's a place you go for a holiday, the people live in harmony, it's mm-hmm. so lovely for a postcard.
We hear that all the time.
Yes, you hear that all the time. And, you know, it's a great marketing tool, I think. But, you know, on the ground, there are all these larger issues. I mean, Bridget just touched on this as well, right? It boils down to the ways in which Sabahans are empowered, of course, by way of funds, federally distributed funds, state distributed funds, because these things translate to better healthcare system, better roads, better, you know, water supply, better education systems, simple things like working classrooms. This is not found in uniformity. It's not standard throughout the state. And the way in which that I think Sabahans sort of think about this or internalize this is that, you know, how do you then sort of, you know, fight for what you need without sort of being told that you're biting the hand that feeds? And I think this becomes very difficult because then you fall into this sort of performative method. You are told to sort of perform for your survival. And, for the better part, a lot of younger Sabahans, I think at least, the chapter on Undi Sabah articulates this very, very well, that there is this new sort of these tremors on the ground indicating that generationally there are younger Sabahans trying to find new ways of reclaiming their agency, right? Mm-hmm. Either through having open discussions with themselves, through sort of narrowing the gap between different ethnic groups, different classes, certainly different classes, of course, and also recognizing this huge gender problem that's happening in the state. So I think generally this is what it means, that there needs to be a recognition between, you know, being able to reclaim agency, having empowerment, so on and so forth, but also being faced with this wall of challenges that is still really tied into the sort of local politics, the way in which this old politics is still in place.
And tell me about this gender politics, because I think the book concludes that gender matters in Sabah. How so?
You know, Bridget wrote about this so beautifully in one of her articles. I'm going to pass the mic over to her
yes,
in a bit.
Bridget,
but I do want to sort of highlight that mm-hmm. At this point, I think it's very clear to us that representation matters. It matters so much. You don't see the kind of political change necessarily happening also because there are not enough women represented in local politics. I believe it was something like less than 10% of women stood as candidates in the field, not won. There's
right.
a difference. And I think like maybe in the single digits, Bridget can sort of correct me on this, actually won a place in the elections. And, you know, it has a lot to do with the way in which women are not necessarily included in the political narratives. Women are sort of seen, I think there's by design, you're still seen as being relegated to your domestic work. And it has a lot to do, I think, also with the level of loyalty that women and men sort of take. Frogging is a term in political frogging, the idea that people jump from one political party to another
right.
constantly in Sabah. And most of them, of course, have been men, right? So, you know, one of the things that people say on the ground is that this would not happen if you had women because they'd be more loyal to their particular parties. But I think, you know, Bridget obviously has, I don't want to speak on her behalf. And as I said, she wrote this really fantastic piece in the book. Bridget?
Villa, you're always very kind. I think what we see are just two points that I would add is that the campaigns don't engage women in Sabah.
Right.
It's pretty clear. All right. I mean, it's not just about they choose as candidates, but they don't really, their messages, their engagement. And this is a little bit different than in Peninsular Malaysia, where parties like UMNO have very powerful women's branches. And what we saw in some ways is that they're more included, more women candidates. Mm-hmm. We don't see enough of that in Sabah. And not to say that there aren't very important women candidates that did get elected, like Gunny's Lisembang, for example. We do find, however, that we don't see enough engagement. And the second thing is also that women are very important in terms of determining outcomes. And this is actually, and so this is what we see is that they're doing this at their own peril, right? In the context is that women tend to be more loyal, and they also have engaged with change in very different sets of ways. And I think that campaigns are really making a mistake by not addressing not only women, but also the issues that women care about. And this goes back to the issues of politics of survival, which have to do with issues of education, issues of health, conditions of services on the ground, that are people's livelihoods. And for people that are voting, they're voting about the things that are going to make them better, give them opportunities, give them hopes, give them future. And I think that when you leave out women from these conversations and in the way that you campaign, you do it as a big mistake. And in fact, I think this actually, shaped the results in many ways particularly for Warisan, where I think they might have done more outreach in these areas. But not only that, all the parties need to shift and change their type of engagement in order to be more inclusive in the way that they're campaigning.
What I found very interesting, though, Bridget, is I think in that chapter where gender is discussed, I mean, I think it was you who you wrote how you were, you had these conversations with people on the ground, and they said, you asked them, do you want a woman a representative? And they say, yes. Are you going to vote for one this time around? And they said, no.
It's not that they're afraid of voting for women. They're voting for things that make them secure.
Right.
And that they're comfortable with. And in this particular context, they voted for someone who was connected to their family, which provided the patronage network, which would allow them to have security and comfort. And in a sense, when you're living in a situation of vulnerability where there's high levels of insecurity, you want to be able to have access to people to be able to help you or to be able to resolve problems. And so, in Peninsular Malaysia, you can look at the issues of gender, saying from a perspective of a female candidate. But when the parties don't include women, then the women cannot be the people who can actually provide those security.
Right.
And the parties aren't including and empowering women to the degree that they should. And so that you have the impact that these choices do get resonated on the ground, and it becomes a vicious cycle. Right. I mean, like, for goodness sake, GRS did not make a woman a minister. Why? And this is something that could have changed if there would have been political will. And with respect and recognition that gender is important from a perspective of connecting to communities. And also, by empowering women, you're empowering the society. Because this is passed on to children. This is also, it's about including everyone in this context. And keep in mind, women are more than half the voters.
Exactly. I think that's very well said. Ben, another group that is important, in fact, their importance has been growing even more so over the past year or past couple of years. And I'm talking about the youth movement, right? We have a growing youth movement in Malaysia, which is great. But what are some of the things you observed about Sabahan youths in terms of their political leanings? What do they want to see change?
Oh, with the youth, I think we have essentially two chapters dedicated to that. We have one chapter from written by representatives from UNI Sabah who really sort of related how their experiences on the ground, and they were very, very heartened that, the support by young Sabahans to engage in politics was very, 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 very prominent. And we also had a chapter by Trixie Tangir, who really talked about how, like Kota Kinabalu Sabahan youths actually have a very, very deep and very, very interested vested interest in participating in politics. And that's something that I think in the last year, in the last couple of years, you know, from the point where the discussion of Undi 18 started to come about, that was when there was this discussion about how are you too young or immature to participate in politics? And I think this is actually going against this general dogmatic view that Malaysians have always had. You know, this whole idea of how we had the Universities Act that limited political participation in universities. There's this understanding that as a youth, you should be focusing on building up your knowledge, building up your skill set so that you can become a contributing member of society first before you engage in politics, which is, and I think when we looked at the discussion of Undi 18, especially recently with the delay of the register of the lowering of the voting age, that people have started to bring up these same arguments again, that, you know, the youth actually are immature, they shouldn't be here. You know, you've got former minister Syed Saddiq, who constantly gets attacked for being of a certain age as a minister. Mm-hmm. And in our chapters discussing this, we really sort of see that the youth actually do have a very, very strong engagement, and they are pushing back against this very, very antiquated or archaic view that youth are not mature enough to engage in politics, because they do engage with it in a very, very deep level. They do think very clearly about who they are voting for, what are their political rights, and they actually are daring enough to actually break away from the old views of what is going to be important to think about during an election, you know, in terms of, you know, and this is quite evident when we looked at how they engaged with MA63, where a lot of them just felt that it was so far removed. These are things that are not necessarily reflective of what's on the ground, and we should actually be more forward thinking rather than looking back constantly in that sense. And I think that's something that we found very, very interesting. And going back to the whole idea of politics or survival, and that's the one thing that we find that, you know, there's this very, very big misconception amongst Peninsular Malaysians that why is it that they can't seem to understand why? And even myself, you know, it took me a while. I'm not from Sabah, of course. And, you know, I've been learning a lot as I edited this book and also did a lot of this research. And there's just always this understanding about why is it that Sabahans, despite the fact that they have so many attempts of political jumping or political frogging that takes place on almost a yearly or bi-yearly basis at this point, why is it that the voters seem to vote against their best interests? Why is it that people with the money always seem to drive things out? So, and that's where we really sort of like try to sort of like take a step back and really look at these issues. And we find that different communities therefore have different assertions of how they vote. And that's the crux of this idea that we're looking at, this of survival. You know, people don't really have the same agency over in Sabah compared to over here. Here you really, certain groups here have the sort of like you have the context, the autonomy to actually vote for what you like ideologically and whatnot. Whereas in Sabah, I think the only chapter that really highlighted where we had a group that could vote on an ideological level were the Chinese Sabahans, because they were economically secure in that sense. And so that's sort of like an overview of how everything goes in that sense. And I think it's if you really were worried about how youths are engaging in politics in Malaysia, I think the chapters that we have here really do show that youths are very, very engaged and actually are a lot more enlightened and probably more actually have a very deep understanding of a lot of issues compared to some people from even the older generation in that sense. You're a lot more open-minded.
I just wanted to add, yes. I think I slightly disagree with what Ben was saying just now, that I do think that Sabahans have as much agency as everyone else. I think that, but I think that they use their agency in very different ways. And I think that this is very important for people to understand. That people that, you know, when, for example, money politics is played and voters are given funds, they're voting for those funds don't make, they're important during the election time. And they're significant because incomes from many communities, from many in Sabah are low. But at the same juncture, they're not voting because of the money. They're voting because this is providing the security and they're making choices for their families in that context. And that is, I think, important to recognize, and it shouldn't be dismissed. I mean, in fact, it should be what the issues that we're trying to suggest need to be thought about is how can Sabah have more development? How can these issues of inequality be addressed in fundamental ways that can actually, transform the society, give more opportunities to people, where that this type of politics doesn't have to be one that rests on survival, but gives them, I think, a sense of wider sets of choices that I think that they deserve.
Bridget, speaking of money, when we talk about Sabah politics, right, for example, heading into the last Sabah state elections, every time you speak to analysts, whether it's yourself, whether it's James Chin, whether it's anyone, right, there's the one common thread that we always hear is that, well, it's Sabah elections. That means you know what's going to happen on the night before. It's going to be raining cash. Everyone says this. They talk about the money, the machinery, the kind of patronage. Paint a picture for those of us who live in the Klang Valley. We don't really see the struggles of what they're going through, and we don't really see how this money and machinery really works.
So most people think it's a vote, that the money goes towards actually paying for people to vote. Mm. But in fact, most of the costs have to pay for the transportation to take the voter to the voting
right.
place. All right. Or the loss of income in order to actually, for them to go vote, because they have day jobs. And if they don't have that day job, then they lose the money for that day. And they have to leave their community where they might be working in a farm or in a plantation or in working in terms of its everyday small business. What we see as a circumstances is that those funds disproportionately provide offset, that and they're expected. And what we saw is that both the major alliances provided money politics, and that both Warisan PH as well as GRS, but obviously in some seats it was more important than others, and we could see that it also is tied to the level of poverty in the community, where resources are seen as necessary and expected, and also we can see those in certain remote seats. But what we found in terms of the research is that because both sides were using money politics, that sometimes this didn't matter as much as it used to before, and that this reflects that the reality that politics in Sabah is changing. Mm. It's evolving in different ways. And I think it's important to recognize that the politics in Malaysia as a whole, in Sabah, of course, is transforming. And so, to use kind of a simplistic analysis that this is about, bribing a voter and those who have more money can have more bribes, therefore they win, doesn't necessarily capture the dynamics on the ground.
Hmm. All right. Like I brought up earlier, right, this book, although we are covering a lot in this, 40 minutes or so podcast, it barely scratches the surface of the contents of the book, right? So I definitely recommend everyone check it out. Ben, where can people get the book?
Oh, okay. So currently the book is on a pre-order sale right now on Gurab Budaya's website. You can pick it up there. I think it's also available on Shopee, and it's also available in various local bookstores, like, Kinokuniya, Popular. So I believe that you can find them there. I believe the stocks are still arriving in Sabah. So for Sabah, you can order it directly from Grab Budaya's online website and they will deliver it to you. But these are the general places that are there. I think there's still copies available. So please do make your way to get them in that set.
In yes. Sabah, look out for Borneo Shop, where the books are coming to. And I think they're also going to be in Popular.
All right. Fantastic. And on that note, thanks so much for speaking with me today, guys.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks
so much.
I've been chatting with Bridget Wells, Vilashini Somaya, and Benjamin Low, who published the book Sabah from the Ground, the 2020 Elections and the Politics of Survival, which really, I would say, paints a detailed picture about Sabah politics, the nuances and the grey areas that go with it. So if you missed any part of this conversation, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app and on BFM.my. You just have to search Beyond the Ballot Box. You've been listening to Beyond the Ballot Box with me, Dafrin Johan, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.